First slide, this is talk about spectrum cosmology, and in particular I would like to present a recent result, since now spectrum cosmology is also the cosmological constant. This is a work that I have done in Marseille with Carlo Rovelli, Eugenio Bianchi, and Thomas Krajewski for what concerns the introduction of the cosmological constant. So in the first slide, you find also the reference, the preprint numbers of the papers on which this talk is based. So let's start and go to slide number two. So let me start by a comment on the relationship between loop quantum gravity and cosmology. Loop quantum cosmology is one of the most successful applications of loop quantum gravity. It has been constructed, as usual in quantum cosmology, by restricting general relativity to a sufficiently symmetric model, but eventually with fluctuations. So this is a story that started more than 10 years ago. By now, we have a full loop quantum gravity theory that is sufficiently developed to do calculations. And this is sufficiently developed to ask how, applying the appropriate approximations, we can obtain cosmology and, let me say, hopefully, loop quantum cosmology. Well, recently, loop quantum gravity has grown exploiting the spin-form formalism. And in this formulation, this is what I wanted to show in this talk. In this formulation, it's possible to do cosmology, taking certain expansions that are characteristic of the quantum. So, in the spin-form formalism, there has been major developments in the last couple of years, and recently there have been two major improvements. So now the theory contains matter in the form of fermions and Young-Mills spins, and this is a very recent result that appeared just a couple of months ago, and it is due to a bunch of people. That are Bianchi, Anne, Magliaro, Perini, Rovelli, Wieland. And also another result that is very recent, and in fact it dates back to the last December, is the fact that it's one pass to the quantum groups, we can have also the cosmological constant in the spin-form model. This was actually an old idea by Smolin, Major, and other people, but it has been recently realized. And so now we have this cuneiform formulation of its theory, and that is due to Firben and Mosbauer in Hamburg, and independently, Hahn in Marseille has also found the same results. But unfortunately, we don't have yet the analysis of the asymptotic behaviors of the cuneiformous vertex. So what we wanted to present in this talk is something different. What we have done is a direct modification of the vertex, and this modification is motivated heuristically by the canonical theory, and it has been inspired also by the work of Bianca Dietrich on vertex induction. So we expect that this modification would correspond to the expansion of the quantum group for small lambda and large spin. Okay. So what I want to show in this talk is that starting from the transition amplitude, with this simple new term, it is possible to obtain in the semi-classical limit the de Sitter space, so a non-trivial solution of GR. The reasons of interest are double. Of course, the first reason of interest is that This shows that there exists some approximation that yield the cosmology starting from the quantum theory. But there is also a second reason, that is that this result reinforced the thesis that the full quantum theory has its semi-classical limit, general relativity. So there was a previous result, the paper that is called Towards the Stefan Cosmology, that was already pointing this direction, but it was in the flat space. So obtaining a non-flat solution like the sitter is non-trivial and gives further support to this conjecture. And so I wanted to stress that at this stage we don't have a quantum correction. They have not been studied yet. And this is a very recent result that is, of course, less developed than loop quantum cosmology. But for the moment, this is not about finding an improvement with respect to loop quantum cosmology. So the problem that we want to address here is how one can arrive to cosmology starting from the full quantum theory. Next slide, I present you the plan of the talk. So in order to explain you our result, I need to recall the present definition of the full theory. Let me say that I will do it in a contemporary fashion. And second, I wanted to discuss the approximations that characterize the theory. And I want to discuss how this approximation can lead to cosmology. What is new here, what is interesting, is that what we are doing is not to impose the classical symmetries, but we are looking for what replaces the classical symmetries in the quantum theory. So finally, I want to study the semi-classical limit. I want to show how the sitter solution emerges. And I will use different techniques in order to do this. I will discuss the transition amplitude, and I will discuss also how to transfer the information from the transition amplitude to the Hamiltonian cosmology. So let's start by so there is some noise that has been added to the. Can you hear me well?
No, we're
not very well, no.
So there is some more noise after the last person that joined us. I try to go ahead. So we started from the main part of the talk. I wanted to introduce, I wanted to define the theory. So let me start from the kinematics. The theory is defined on a sum of graph spaces. The graphs that we consider are abstract graphs, defined just by the number of nodes, the number of links, and the first target relation that gives the adjacency. Each graph space is a neighbor space. And the Hilbert space of a given graph contains all the subspaces corresponding to the subgraphs and to all the graphs that can be obtained by a permutation. So on each graph space, we have the two sets of operators. For each link, we have an holonomy operator that acts as a multiplicative operator, and the triad operator that acts as a left-invariant vector field. Finally, the states. The states are spin network states that are gauge invariant. And now, for this work, we are interested in the semi-classical behavior. So let's consider semi-classical states. And this is the argument of the next slide, slide number 5. So we want to use a semi-classical states. These states have been introduced in loop quantum gravity a long time ago by lots of people, Ashtekar, Levadovsky, Marosh, Murao. Tiemann has worked a lot on them. Recently, they've been also developed by Friedel, Speziale, and Levin. Here, I will use the formulation given by Bianchi, Magliara, and Perini that is suitable for doing calculation in spin form. So, let's look at question number one. Here we have the coherent states, the definition of coherent states. These coherent states provide an overcomplete basis in the loop quantum gravity of the states, and they are defined as follows. So there is a group averaging on HU2, so that the states are gauge invariant, and there is an if kernel KT on HU2, analytically continued to SL2C. So this is a function that is concentrated on the origin of the group with a spread of the order T. And in equation number two, I report the explicit form of this heat kernel, where the term DJ is the Wigner matrix of the spin J representation of HU2. What is the role of this heat kernel? So the heat kernel pick the states on a given intrinsic and extrinsic geometry, and this corresponds to pick the state on a given SL2C element, and we do this once for each link. The SL2C element H, that is written in equation 3, this object can be expressed in terms of a boost in the rotation, and it is labeled by four objects that are these vectors n, xi, and theta. So if we associate a cellular decomposition to our abstract graph, we can give a very nice geometric interpretation for this state. So the vectors n and n prime are the normals to the faces of this cellular decomposition, and xi is associated to the strange curvature at the face, and eta is the area of the face. Is actually the area of the face divided by the Planck length. So these states provide a convenient basis of wave packets with a very nice geometric interpretation. And we can float to these states as boundary states. So what we want to compute here is the transition amplitude between an initial and a final geometry encoded in this state. So let's go to slide number six. In the covariant framework, the dynamic is given through a transition amplitude, and the spin form amplitude is given by a sum over the spin forms. Namely, we are summing over the two complexes, the spin and the intertwiners. So in equation number four, I consider the partition function for a given two complex. And here we have a sum over the spins J associated to each faces. We have an intertwiner VE associated to each edge. And there is a product of 2j plus 1 that gives the face amplitude. And there is a vertex amplitude that is a function of the spins and the intertwiner agent the ternier of the dire round of the vertex V. It is convenient at this stage to choose a basis of the intertwiners that diagonalize the volume. So, and we label this basis with the eigenvalues of the volume. So, now we are ready to introduce this term, the term in equation number 4 that is in red. And this is the terms that yield the cosmological constant. So this modification has inside this term little lambda that will be related to the cosmological constant. I will show you the exact relation in a couple of slides. And it multiplies the free volume element VE. So this term, as I said, is inspired by the canonical theory, where the cosmological constant appears as a further term in the Hamiltonian constraints that multiplies the free volume. Finally, in this basis, I can write the amplitude of the vertex in equation number 6. And you see that this amplitude is given by an integration over SO4 of this term PT. And we will see, we will study further the form of these PT terms further later in the talk. So this completes the definition of the theory. Let me go to slide number 7. So it is the slide ingredients to do cosmology. What I wanted to do in this slide is to comment about the approximation that we are seeking and explain how this approximation are related to cosmology. The first approximation that we are going to take is the graph truncation. So this graph truncation can be thought as choosing the number of the degrees of freedom that we want to describe. We can choose the graph that is more suitable to do calculation depending on the number of degrees of freedom that we want to describe. So a very simple choice that we can make is the so-called dipole that is shown in the figure in black. So this dipole is a graph we define it just as two nodes and four links, and this is dual to a triangulation of a sphere. So we will make use of this graph in order to do our calculation. This graph, as I said, it's already can be used to do a cosmology that is more rich than the usual cosmology because it contains 6 degrees of freedom. So on this graph, we want to put a certain geometry. The geometry is encoded by the current states.
Sorry, I have a question here. So you say you choose the graph to have the right number of degrees of freedom, but then you just said the graph you've chosen has too many degrees of freedom. Why don't you use a simpler graph?
Because if I would use a simpler graph, you can think that what you usually do in cosmology is to use a trivial graph given just by one node, so you have
right.
Just one point. So we wanted to have something a bit more richer, and I agree that in
why?
The
I mean,
end...
On your first attempt at doing cosmology, shouldn't you just try homogeneous isotropic cosmology with the simplest graph?
Yes, but so with this simpler graph, this is a graph that is very suitable in order to do the calculation because it has a nice interpretation in terms of a triangulation. So the point of view of the geometrical triangulation is more clear what you are doing if you deal with this kind of graph. And also I want to add that, of course, in the end, at this stage, we are interested to look at the homogeneous and isotropic cosmology universe. But what is very interesting here is that putting a coherent state, so this coherent state will be picked, of course, on a certain geometry. This is the point that I was about to address here in the slide. So we choose to pick this coherent state on a homogeneous and isotropic geometry. And a nice feature of this coherent state is that they pick the states both on the intrinsic and the extrinsic curvature. So we have these states that are picked on the area, on the eta, and on the C variable, but they are more rich than just a homogeneous and isotropic state, because in a coherent state, they are superposition of speed network states, so they contain also fluctuation. So I think that, this setting is rich, but simple enough to describe something more than usual cosmology.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so we have already addressed the second point of this slide. I associate a geometry to this abstract graph, and I wanted to compute a transition amplitude between an initial and final state, namely to, you see in the picture, there is a transition from a free sphere triangulated by the dipole and another free sphere triangulated by another dipole. So in the picture, you see that there is just one big red vertex. So the third approximation that we are considering is the vertex expansion. Here we consider just the first order of this vertex expansion, and this corresponds to consider just a single vertex. Finally, I am interested in the semi-classical limits. What gives us the semi-classicality are the fact that we are using the coherent space and taking the limit of large distance. So considering the large distance will correspond to have a large spin. And having large spin make all the picture coherent and well-defined. So let's go to the next slide. This is, the most technical slide of the talk, but stay with me because I wanted to give you at least a bit of the flavor of the calculation that we have done. So in question number 7, this is the transition amplitude that we wanted to compute. This will be a function of the initial and the final states. So you see that the W is a function of Z and Z prime. So being considering the first order in the vertex expansion, we can exploit the nice feature that the transition amplitude is factorized in two terms. So I can just study for the moment the one of these terms. Recall now that the transition amplitude W was just the integration of the P term. So the form of the P term is written in equation number 8. And this P term contains a representation J of the SL2C element H. That SL2C element H has the expression number 9. And I want to look in particular to the terms that is associated. So inside the PT terms, inside the trace of the PT terms, we have a representation of H, but this is just the product of the representation of each term. So let's look at the representation J of A to the minus E zeta sigma phi half. And so this term in the large distance limit, that is the limit for actually, so this is the limit for the imaginary part of Z being big. So in this limit, this object goes as the exponential times a projector P. So this object, this projector, projects on the highest magnetic number. And this fact has the nice feature that allows us to take the term A to the minus E zeta J out of the trace. And when we compute the transition amplitude, again, this is given by the integration over of with inside PT. When we do this integration, the variables that are integrated are all inside this trace, and the evaluation of this integral has been done by Livina Speziale. So we can recognize that this is just the measure of the regular tetrahedra studied by Livina Speziale, and we know that this object goes like a constant times J to the minus 3. And this is the final result that it is written in equation number 13. Okay? So now we want to evaluate. This is our transition amplitude. Equation 13 is the object that we are interested in. And this is the object that we want to evaluate. So let's go to the next slide. How to evaluate this object? First of all, we need to now this object. Note that this object is written with the new cosmological constant term. I want, in order to evaluate it, I note that this object is kicked on J equal J0, so I can expand around J0, and once I do this, I can see that W goes like approximate a Gaussian sum. So now I want to understand where this Gaussian sum is picked. And in equation, the condition to have for this Gaussian sum to be picked is in equation 16. So we want is a condition on the imaginary part of Z. And so being a Gaussian sum, also there is a phase that suppresses the amplitude everywhere, but where the imaginary part of the exponent is zero or it is a multiple of 2 pi. So this is a condition on the real part of Z. Putting everything together and remembering that the real part of Z is associated to the extrinsic curvature and the imaginary part of Z is associated to the area, I can write the last row, equation number 18, and I find the Friedmann equation for the De Sitter space. And
I have a comment here as well, please. So you say you have the Friedmann equation for the De Sitter space, but your spatial slice is S3, right? So this should have some sort of curvature term as well. There should be a 1 over ka here.
But okay, you should remember. Yes, you should remember that in every case there are different ways for slicing the sitter space. So you can slice the sitter space also as a slice space. Nevertheless, if you want, here we are taking a large distance approximation. What does it mean? It means that if there would be there a term that goes like k over a square, these terms can be neglected in this approximation. So this is the reason why we don't get it. On the other hand, I want to add that it's possible to study the k, the curvature term, in state form. This has been done by Magliaro, Perini, and Marciano. But this doesn't change our results. So it would be just in the evaluation of the amplitude, this can be seen as a term that multiply our transition amplitude. And this is also the fact that you can see these terms in this way is because you can, as you said, you can slide the sitter space in different ways. So this is a more convenient way to see it.
I have a very naive question. So as I understood, like, you are working in a Euclidean setting, right?
So actually, okay, I have shown this calculation for the Euclidean case, because it's simpler, and this is what we have done in the paper that we have published. The only difference that you can have if you consider the Lorentzian case would be in the calculation of the trace, the calculation that I have shown in the previous slide. And so this integration over the trace and so on. But if you do such a calculation, you see that in every case, this corresponds again to a constant times a term that goes as a term j to the minus 3. So
my question is regarding this calculation in the Euclidean setting. So in the Euclidean setting, if you in the equation 18, if one derives a cosmological model in the Euclidean signature, one should get a negative sign on the right-hand side with lambda. So your lambda is positive, and this equation is only valid if you have a Lorentzian signature, but you are having a Euclidean signature, so you should be getting a negative sign.
Well, actually, as I said, I think that no, I say that in our calculation, so this calculation, the result of this calculation is valid also for the Lorentzian case.
No, that is a separate calculation if it is done for the Lorentzian case. But my comment is only for this calculation, that I don't know, like, how one can say that this is the right Friedman equation in the Euclidean setting.
In order to obtain a Euclidean case, you would change the lambda. The lambda that I suspect, actually, I didn't think about this, but I think that the solution of this problem would be in the form of the little lambda that we have.
So if your definition of lambda is given by the small equation in equation 18 with lambda square, then your small lambda will have to be imaginary. Only then the capital lambda will become negative. And only then equation 18 will be the correct Friedman equation with a Euclidean signature.
May I comment? This is Alex Parici. I think what we should interpret this is that we are actually getting a negative cosmological constant in the Euclidean case. And that is also consistent in the sense that if you would have a Euclidean four-dimensional space with a negative cosmological constant, the global symmetric group is exactly the same as Lorentzian signature with a positive cosmological constant. cosmological constant.
Yes, I agree to that. But
telling us.
So my point is that if you want to do that, then your small lambda has to be imaginary.
The equation is telling you has this sign, which means that if you write it, equation 18 as a Euclidean Friedman equation, you have to put a minus, which means that big lambda is negative.
Yes, I agree to that. Okay. So big lambda is negative, but then one cannot. Then I do not understand how the approximation was done, where the intrinsic curvature term went away, because it was assumed that the lambda is positive, and then one gets something like a accelerated expansion, and then one can neglect that kind of term. But if the lambda is, as you agree with me, that in equation 18, the lambda is negative, like it is just written in the form where it looks positive.
Yes.
So my basic point is that, like, the way it is written, this equation is not right, and the approximation is not done in the right way.
I don't agree with this, because the approximation the approximation. So you are correct when you say that you should have this k over a squared terms, but we are in the approximation in which this is disregarded.
No, but like one has to justify it, right? Like I agree with you that one can, in principle, go to a regime where the scale's intrinsic curvature term can go to zero. For example, if you take the Lorentzian signature, there if you write down the Friedman equation, it will be a dot squared by a squared equal to lambda by 3 plus 1 over a squared. So if lambda is large enough, you can always do that approximation. But now you are working with the Euclidean signature, so your actual equation is a dot squared by a squared equal to minus lambda by 3 minus 1 over a squared, because it's a Euclidean signature. Your Hamiltonian part, which had a lapse n squared, had shifted its sign to minus 1. So one has to do the approximation carefully. I'm just saying this.
Okay, I will look further on this, but I think that the equation number 18 holds in the approximation that we are taking. So, okay, maybe we can discuss further after the talk. Let me go forward to slide number 9. Okay. So in actually this is slide number 10. So we have done a lot of approximation, in fact. And how are we sure that everything works well and that we are doing the right approximation? So we have checked this numerically. And in the picture and at your left, so it is shown the relation between A dot and A. So there is the characteristic linear dependence between A and A dot that is characteristic in the De Sitter space. This is related also with the issue that we have discussed before, because what is the form of this little lambda, the term in our the parameter in our cosmological constant term? So one can ask what is the right choice of the sign of little lambda. So actually, our discussion is independent of this choice, because recall that we were considering only half of the transition amplitude. The total transition amplitude is given by two terms with opposite time orientation. So there is a different sign. And this could be seen in the calculation like having a term with plus and a term with minus little lambda. So the total amplitude, as I said, is independent of the choice of the sign of lambda. Let me make a comment about the figure on your right, because it could be a bit misleading. One can think that we are sort of recalling the bounds in this, figure. Actually, I would not trust what happens for very small for a small scale factor. Okay, so I want to do another evaluation of the transition amplitude. Let's go to slide number 11. So, in our previous work towards spin-form cosmology, we have used a different technique to evaluate the amplitude in the semi-classical limit. So let me do the same thing here. I wanted to show that the present result is consistent with the previous one. And also I want to show you this technique because it could be interesting in itself. So recall that the transition amplitude projects on the physical states. It should be a solution of the Hamiltonian constraint. So in our first work, we noticed that there was an operator that annihilated the transition amplitude W, and that this is the operator in equation number 19. So let me do, and in this expression, we disregarded the term that has H because we are taking the large distance limit. So let me do the same here for our new transition amplitude with a cosmological constant. Just doing some algebra, you obtain equation number 20. Equation number 21 is some algebra again. And this is just to show that this operator that we associated to the Hamiltonian the canonical Hamiltonian constraint gives, in fact, again with some algebra the same Friedmann equation for the theta space. So what is very nice here and could be interesting for people doing cosmology is that starting from the spin-form transition amplitude, it's possible to derive an effective Hamiltonian constraint. So, next slide, the last slide, I want to summarize, make some comments on what we have done. I have shown that there is a simple way to add the cosmological constant in the spin-form formalism. It is possible to compute this transition amplitude explicitly. And in order to perform the calculation, we have used some approximation, the graph expansion, the vertex expansion, and the large volume expansion that are characteristic of the quantum theory. We have seen that there is a precise sense in which these approximations yield cosmology, and the transition amplitude computer appears to give the correct semi-classical limit, namely the Friedmann dynamics with the cosmological constant. So the interest of this result is lay in the fact that, of course, this theory is not a final theory, is still under development. We don't know if it is the correct theory, but this result, the fact that we are able to recover a non-trivial solution of general relativity, namely we recover the De Sitter space starting from the spin-form transition amplitude, give us confidence that this is the good theory. And I have finished.
Questions?
So I also have a question about the approximations taken between 19 and 22. So in equation 19, you drop a term of order h bar.
Yep.
And you end up with equation 22, which is the Friedman equation. But your capital lambda, according to the definition in question in equation 18, has an h bar squared in it. And so why are you dropping a term of order h bar in favor of a term of order h bar squared?
Okay, in the large distance approximation, your these terms doesn't give important contribution. I agree that it would be interesting to study this term. This, in fact, has been done at least in the case without the cosmological constant by our postdoc in Marseille, Christian Roque. I would agree that it would be interesting to ask the study.
Well, my question is more about the consistency of the limit you've taken. What have you held constant in getting here, and what have you dropped?
Can I
intervene? Why do you say that there's an h bar squared? Where is the h bar squared?
Equation 18 says capital lambda is little lambda squared g squared h bar squared. Equation 18 on slide 9.
But this is just lambda squared being 1 over h bar squared. Lambda, large lambda is classical. So
little lambda has a 1 over h bar squared, had 1 over h bar on it.
Yeah, large lambda is classical, right? So it survives in the classical limit. So large lambda has no h bar squared, h bar in it.
Yes, except I should have said that this lambda has the capital lambda as the correct dimension of the cosmological constant, namely it has dimension of 1 over an area. So in fact, yes, maybe in equation 18, the way it is written is a bit misleading. Carlo was right.
Okay,
can I ask a question?
Go ahead.
Yes, so I know it wasn't part of your work, but your work was inspired by the work of Winston and Catherine Newsom on the quantum deformation to get the cosmological constant. Can you combine your results with their results to get a relationship between the quantum deformation parameter Q they use, or its logarithm, and the cosmological constant in H bar and G?
Actually, I would like to combine the two results. So this work goes exactly in this direction, in the sense that we would like to have something with which we can compare their results. I think that this is the theory with which they have to compare the results in the Q-deformed formulation. Maybe, I don't know if here Mushin has further comments on this.
Yeah, we are working on this direction. So, we should do some computation on this. And, there's some complication in the quantum deformation case, but we hope in the future we'll over those difficulties. Okay, that's the only thing I can.
Okay, one more question along that line. Is it possible to stare at the original equation that defined little lambda equation 4 and knowing the asymptotic properties of the vertex amplitude to make an argument that the sum over representations is cut off at some representation J and use that to get a relationship between little lambda and the representation J where the sum would be cut off and thereby, because we know where the quantum deformation acts in a similar fashion.
I don't have an answer for this. We should wait for more works on this. And we will surely take into account your comments for further works.
Okay, thank you.
More questions? Well, so I have a question. The one of the original motivations for spin foams was to try to guide people doing the canonical theory towards the right Hamiltonian constraint, so to speak. And even in the simple setting of loop quantum cosmology, there are several possibilities for doing a loop quantization. I mean, we know there's a mu zero quantization, the mu bar quantization, and so on and so forth. Could one argue that, this spin foam treatment picks one of those over the other, or is there enough freedom that you could have gotten any result you wanted?
At this moment, we don't have evidence to pick up one or the other formulation in quantum cosmology, namely the mu zero or the mu bar formulation. This was my initial hope during spin foam cosmology, was exactly this, to be able to find a way to understand better the problem that was present in loop quantum cosmology. At the moment, I don't have an answer about this. What the direction that we are taking is that the problem that we see in a loop quantum cosmology can be seen like understanding which is the, let's say, the periodic variable of the theory. So what one can do here in spin foam cosmology is to look again what is the periodic variable here. For the moment, yes, we are studying it. We are studying this periodicity, but I don't have a final answer now.
So, but what would you have to change here if you wanted to get, say, mu zero instead of mu bar?
But here is a completely different framework because we don't have such a term. The term mu zero, mu naught, mu bar appears in the canonical theory in the way the Hamiltonian constraint is regularized. So here the regularization is taken in a completely different way. And so we don't have such a new term. The new term doesn't appear here.
Okay. More questions?
I see is to study the periodicity of this transition amplitude. Maybe studying the further terms. So here we have studied only the semi-classical limit. We have not taken into account the quantum correction. So it would be very interesting to go further with this study, to study the further the quantum correction. And so having the quantum correction, we will make a more strict contact with the loop quantum cosmology, where the quantum correction are in fact taken into account.
Okay, thanks.
Can I ask another question?
Go ahead.
Yes, so a basic phenomenology of quantum theory in de Sitter space-time that is a general result of the semi-classical theory is that de Sitter space-time is hot, it has a temperature, and one sees that, for example, by any endpoint function in being periodic in the imaginary de Sitter time, which that's the result of Gibbons and Hawking and Perry and so forth. Can you use your method or your amplitude to see directly that there is a periodicity in the Euclidean time and de Sitter space time?
I think so. No. It's a good question, and we should look at this. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't know if someone wants to know. Yeah, I was looking for someone to comment first. But no, we don't have an answer yet.
More questions?
Okay.
Okay, let's thank Francesca again.